All right, good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to the second meeting of the PCOB's Investor Advisory Group. I want to thank all the members for participating and donating your time and expertise to this group. I especially want to thank SEC Chairman Mary Shapiro for attending, and also Jim Croker, your chief accountant, and Mike Starr and Brian Croteau. Chairman Shapiro, we all know how valuable your time is, and your presence today means a tremendous amount to us. I know you will only be here, be able to stay until 11:45. 11:15, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
First mistake.
My 12 o'clock appointment. 11:10.
But the fact that you would take time out to attend today's meeting in order to hear directly from this advisory group is a reminder that protecting the interest of investors is at the heart of everything the SEC and the board do. I also know that you have testified six times before Congress since February, including yesterday before the House Appropriations Committee on the SEC's budget, twice last week, and three other times since mid-February, and that the Dodd-Frank Act mandates over 100 rulemakings and requires you to conduct over 20 studies. So once again, thank you for coming and for your leadership of the SEC during these highly challenging times. And at one point, I think there was some forces here in town who wanted to do away with the SEC, and you certainly won that battle. So congratulations. Achieving the best results for investors often requires that the board work closely with the commission, and particularly with Jim Croker and his office, and we appreciate the cooperative relationship that has developed between our two organizations. The auditors regulated by the board have a clear mandate to protect investors, which comes from the statutory franchise granted by Congress to the accounting profession in the 1930s to audit the financial statements of U.S. publicly traded companies. The United States Supreme Court reminded auditors that this, quote, public watchdog function demands that they maintain total independence from the client at all times and requires complete fidelity to the public trust. And I would stress that those words, total independence, come right from the Supreme Court. The board in turn has an equally clear mandate, which is stated in the very first words of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, quote, an act to protect investors by improving the accuracy and reliability of corporate disclosures made pursuant to the securities laws, close quote. And the very first section of Title I of the Act states that there is established the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board to oversee the audit of companies, once again, to protect the interest of investors in the preparation of informative, accurate, and independent audit reports. So hearing from this group and other investor representatives is vital to the board and the account auditing profession successfully fulfilling their statutory mandates. In my opinion, Chairman Shapiro, you foresaw much of what is on our agenda today in your speech before the AICPA last year on December 6, 2010, when you not only recognized the critical role played by accountants in our capital markets, but you queried whether, quote, questions could have been asked early on by preparers and auditors, or if warning flags were simply ignored. And you went on, we wonder if the eventual losses to shareholders and investors were multiplied many times because material information was not made available in a timely fashion by people who should have been able to produce accurate disclosures. Our investor advisory group will be discussing those issues, among others, today. Before turning to the schedule, I would like to recognize at the outset our new chairman, Jim Doty, and then you, Chairman Shapiro, for any brief remarks you would each like to make, and then I will recognize our former chairman, Dan Geltzer, and our other new board members, Lou Ferguson and Jay Hansen. And afterwards, I would like all members at the table to introduce themselves, and then we will get on with today's program. Chairman Doty.
Thank you, Steve. First, let me thank you for the leadership you've shown in forming this group and getting us all together. I also want to thank Jim Croker, Mike Starr, Brian Croteau, and staff of the Commission for the extraordinary support they've already shown us and the help they've given us on a number of areas, including getting out the China research that we've done earlier this week, and it's been a great help. And finally, Chairman Shapiro. I have watched Chairman Shapiro's career over a significant period of time, And the lesson I have taken away from it is that everything she does and everything she touches, she gets involved in to make a difference. She's made an enormous difference at every post she has held. And it has taught me that you don't do something like this unless you intend to make a difference. It is our purpose in serving on this board, and I speak, I know, for every board member, that we intend to make a difference, a positive difference, in the grave issues that face us in our securities regime. It is also something we hear a lot about at this time in terms of burnout and cynicism. Where I come from, there are a lot of people talking about burnout. Burnout is usually a product of cynicism and boredom and a doubt that what you're doing does make a difference. And I'm here to tell you that among the staff members of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board who line this wall and sit behind me, there is no burnout. I have been to the offices. We are going to the offices of the board. I'm impressed by the fact that there is tremendous incentive to do the job and get on with the job of the board. There is tremendous commitment to the mission of the board and enthusiasm about what they can do by way of making a difference. With that said, I would just say we have a statement that is before you and is available, and it underscores the fact that we think that a number of the issues we'll be talking about today are not remote academic projects of the board. They are eminent interests. We want to hear from you about the role of auditors in the global financial crisis, what you think the perception of the audit profession and what was done or not done in the audit profession during those events should signify to us. We are going to be taking up imminently proposals about the role of the auditor in the process and the audit report, the form and content of the auditor's report. What auditors say about what they do is of great interest to us. It is also clear that in the global firm, there are issues that are quite imminent. It is a matter of clear concern to us that often there is not appreciation of who does what work and what lies underneath the report of the auditor. All these are areas in which I may say that I think the presence of the firms that are here today exhibit, among other things, a real recognition that these are issues and that we are not going to return to a regime in which they are simply ignored. I think the profession itself sees that imminent change is on the way, that it has to be significant, and that there must be things done to preserve the health of our financial reporting system. In the global network, we have issues abroad. We are very encouraged by the fact that we are going to be reinstituting inspections in the UK. We believe that we are on the cusp of having entrance into other countries on the continent of Europe that will be meaningful and will give our investors an insight into the quality and the credibility of audits. And as you know, we are absolutely convinced that before the Chinese can hope to have the kind of credibility in their own financial system that investors expect long-term, there must be a way of distinguishing among audits in that regime, and at the present time, there's no way of anyone knowing whether an audit that comes out of a Chinese company is a good audit or a bad audit, and that has to change. So there are a number of issues, both domestic and international, that are before us, and I can only tell you that they will be moving forward on an imminent schedule and not a remote schedule with the help and with the collaboration of the SEC. And with that, I would turn it over to Chairman Shapiro.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. It's a real pleasure for me to be here. I want to thank both Jim and Steve for your very kind words of introduction. I'm particularly happy to be here today as you look at the lessons of the past and determine what role auditors ought to be playing in a global financial future. But I'm, I think, most happy to be here because it's the first time since the Supreme Court ended the uncertainty over the PCAOB's future that I've been able to be with all of you. And I think that the seating of Jim Doty and board members Lou Ferguson and Jay Hansen was really a very important event, and not just for the organization, but obviously for all investors. So I'm really thrilled to be here with all of you. I also want to thank Steve Harris and Dan Gelzer for your tremendous leadership during what was clearly a time of uncertainty at a minimum. but one where you kept the organization moving forward. And I think we're all extremely grateful to both of you for your enormous efforts. As you focus today on issues of importance to every investor, it's really comforting to me to know that the board shares my commitment to ensuring that the information on which investors are making their decisions is accurate and in compliance with the federal securities laws. I also want to thank the members of the Investor Advisory Group for the time and the energy and the commitment I know that you put into your work here and into the effort to better inform and protect investors. The recent financial crisis, I think, underscored the need for preparers, for boards, for auditors and regulators to be vigilant about performing their duties, particularly during times of stress. And it's critical that the SEC and the PCAOB learn from that crisis and determine ways to help prevent or at least to mitigate another one. For example, we need to be asking such things as, do financial reporting and audits provide investors with sufficient information for their investment decisions? And can auditor performance under current standards be improved, or do the standards themselves need to be revisited? Suggestions for addressing these key issues in the wake of the financial crisis are being discussed all around the world today, and I think that today's discussion will make a very important contribution to that larger debate. We need to look ahead, though, as well as learning from the past, and today I think you'll consider two issues important to future investors and auditors alike. The first is, what should go into the auditor's report? Today we would like to know what useful information you feel is missing from the auditor's report, and areas where additional input from auditors could add useful transparency. And we'd also like to hear your thoughts regarding who should provide this information, auditors through their reports, management through additional disclosures, or the audit committee. And second, we simply do not have all the information we need to evaluate audit quality, as Jim was just referencing, in some countries, despite the fact that companies from those countries are accessing the U.S. capital markets. The SEC and the PCAOB are working with other regulators to resolve some of these issues, and I am delighted that the PCAOB has reached an agreement with its UK counterpart to be able to resume inspections there. And I do hope that this agreement will form the basis for future cooperation in the UK on oversight and enforcement, and the basis for the PCAOB reaching similar agreements with other jurisdictions in the near term. Today, I'd also be interested to hear your views as to what else can be done to further improve audit quality around the world. For example, are there particular insights into accounting firms that would be useful? If so, what are those insights, and what is their relationship to audit quality? And what specifically can the accounting and auditing profession do to increase auditor objectivity and to maintain and really foster and grow the public's trust and confidence? Just let me conclude by saying that we all share this enormous commitment to investor protection and an interest in discussions like this. I completely agree with Jim. You don't do things like this unless you think you can make a difference, and I think we're very much poised to do that. And so while I won't be with you for the whole meeting today, I'll be here till 11:15 so I can get back to the office by noon. Jim Croker, our chief accountant, will be here, and he'll participate all day in the discussions. And so I will catch up with him later on anything that I might have missed. And I want to thank you again for letting me join you today, and thank the advisory committee members and all of you for your commitment. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Shapiro. Dan?
Thank you, Steve. First, I just want to join my colleagues in welcoming the members of the Investor Advisory Group to today's 2011 meeting of the IAG. As Steve noted in his comments, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act created the PCAOB to protect the interests of investors and further the public interest in the preparation of informative, fair, and independent audit reports and reliable financial reporting. Despite that, integrating the needs and goals of investors into our work is sometimes a challenge. We often hear directly from accounting firms and from preparers of financial statements. However, we receive much less input from the intended beneficiaries, that is, investors. This advisory group is one of the ways that we try to rebalance the scales. I also want to join Steve and Jim in thanking Chairman Shapiro, and SEC Chief Accountant Jim Croker, Deputy Chief Accountant Mike Starr, and Brian Croto for being with us this morning. The board's role in furthering investor interest in reliable financial reporting is just a subset of the Commission's much broader investor protection mandate.
Chairman Shapiro, I know how great the demands are on your time and attention, and I appreciate your support for the board's work and certainly your support for this advisory committee's mission. I think it would be remiss if I didn't also underscore that this meeting wouldn't be taking place if it weren't for Steve Harris's commitment to the success of the advisory group. Since joining the board more than 2 years ago, Steve has made it a crusade to ensure that the board does everything it can to make investor views part of our decision-making. The IAG is certainly one of the tangible results of Steve's efforts. The three topics on the advisory committee's agenda today are the audit-related lessons of the financial crisis, possible changes in the nature and scope of the auditor's report, and the implications of global networks for audit firm governance. Each of these raise key issues to the board's work and can certainly occupy the entire day, probably more than that. I'd just like to say that I'm especially interested in the group's views on changes to the reporting model, that is, whether we should be asking auditors to provide more information than appears in the traditional standardized audit opinion, and if so, how the auditor's communications with financial statement users should expand. The board has begun a project in this area and will be discussing it at a public board meeting next week. There's certainly considerable investor hunger for more insight from the auditor regarding both the audit process and the qualitative aspects of company financial reporting. However, going beyond the time-honored pass-fail audit report would raise some challenging issues. It could potentially be a fundamental change in the auditor's role and could have far-reaching implications for the nature and extent of the audit work performed underlying the report. The advisory group's ideas about how we should go forward with this complex and important project will be, I think, particularly valuable. Thank you, and I'm certainly looking forward to the discussion today.
Thank you very much, Dan, and for the kind remarks. Lou?
Doesn't stop. There it goes. Well, thank you, Steve. I just want to say how delighted I am to be with you all here, and that I feel very pleased and honored that all of you, Chairman Shapiro and the rest of you, would take your time to spend with us, because this is very important. What you do for us, I think, is a tremendously important thing for the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. What's exciting about being on the board right now is that this is a time of extraordinarily and really unprecedentedly rapid evolution in the financial system, in not just in the United States, but in the world, in financial accounting standards and in auditing standards. And given the fact that our primary mission, as everyone up here has said, is the protection of investors, trying to find what is relevant and what is useful to investors in a new and changing environment is something that is one of our main focuses. And this is what I hope to learn from you all today. What can we be doing? What should we be looking at that will be relevant to, useful and helpful to investors? And how do we change these standards in ways that really make information more valuable to investors? So I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Steve.
Good morning, everyone. Also echo the comments from my fellow board members. Very pleased to be here and happy to have all of you here and happy to have Chairman Shapiro here as well. Clearly, we've heard the messages that you all have been reciting that you need more as an investor representatives than what you're getting right now. And to echo Chairman Shapiro's comments and questions about who is the best party to give you that information, I'm really kind of anxious to hear some of the thought process behind that. And clearly, the discussion about the role of the auditor, since I come from an auditor background, is really intriguing to me, because I know what I grew up doing and how the firm structures are organized about what auditors do. And if the role is evolving, that's going to be significant behavioral changes that need to happen in the auditing profession, which is going to be a significant challenge. One of the perspectives that I bring to the board from a career in public accounting is helping them understand that the needs of investors, sadly, is not necessarily in the Constitution. institution of an auditor because it's not really focused on throughout an auditor's career. There's no doubt in my mind that the leaders of the firms have all have the needs of investors in their minds and are trying to effectuate the changes in the firms, but that's it's a long-term process. And one of the personal reflections I have about the changes that I've come to realize in the last few years are necessary is most auditors throughout their careers don't hear from investors, so they don't hear the passion behind the information that you need and why you need it. And so I think there's a lot of outreach that all of you can help with the auditors and the firms to help them understand down to a fairly granular level and with the staff coming up through their careers to so they can better keep it in mind that what they do matters to you. That's the unfortunate loss of the line of sight to the ultimate user of the work of an auditor that is missed sometimes. And so I think there's a lot of behavioral changes that we know we need to work on with the auditing profession, and I think this is a really good start to help us understand better what your needs are. And also, I'll be curious, today might not be the forum for it, but we always talk about cost-benefit. And it'll be easy to measure the cost of additional work that auditors might do or report. The benefit is a little more elusive to measure that benefit. So I'll be curious to hear your thoughts on the cost-benefit part of the challenges that we're facing as well. With that, Steve?
And then, Norman, if we could start with you, maybe very, very briefly, all the Investor Advisory Group members could introduce themselves, and then we'll get started.
Thank you, Steve. Yes, my name is Norman Harrison. First, congratulations, Chairman Doty and the new board members. Chairman Shapiro, always a great pleasure to be with you. Very briefly, my entire career in one form or another has revolved around the capital markets as a corporate attorney, investment banker, more recently as a principal in the investment advisory firm of Breeden Partners, where I've had responsibility for our compliance and oversight regulatory matters. And bring that variety of perspectives to this task. And great pleasure to be here this morning. Thank you.
Okay, let me try that. No, it doesn't work anymore.
Anyway, I'm Tony Sonley, and I run a financial consulting firm, and all of my work involves the use of financial accounting information. So I've always been interested in it from that perspective, and I'm very happy to be here, and welcome to the new members and the new chair. It's good to see you.
It works, and I was with the commission for 20 years, and I've been on the bench for 14 years. And I've always been interested in this field, and I congratulate the PCAOB for having this, and for Steve Harris. I think this is going to be very productive.
I'm Damon Silvers. I'm the policy director and special counsel to the president of the AFL-CIO, and I'm very pleased to be here with all these people who do such great work. Thank you.
Lynn Turner. I, too, was at the commission, including the time when Chairman Shapiro was Commissioner Shapiro and a wonderful person to work with. I currently serve on the board of the Colorado Public Pension Fund.
Mike Starr, Deputy Chief Accountant for Policy in the Office of the Chief Accountant, and I'm also pleased to be here.
Good morning. My name is Robert Tarola. What I bring to the group is experience as a public company auditor, a public company CFO, and now a public company director and audit committee member, both with a public operating company and with investment companies. So pleased to be here and look forward to the dialogue.
I'm Joe Costello. I'm a professor of accounting at the University of Tennessee and director of research for our Corporate Governance Center. And in addition to being on this group, I have the pleasure and honor of being on the SAG.
Hi, I'm Barb Roper with Consumer Federation of America, and I'm sure I'll be pleased to be here once I get another cup of coffee.
Brandon Becker, Executive Vice President and Chief Legal Officer of TIA-CREF. I was formerly at the Commission and at WilmerHale after that. As you know, we rely upon financial statements and the information therein, so we welcome the efforts of the chairs and in particularly Steve's efforts over these past many months to basically successfully herd cats. So thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Ann Yerger with the Council of Institutional Investors, and I'll add my voice to the choir. I'm very happy to be here, and we thank you for all the work you're doing on behalf of investors.
Good morning. Jim Croker, SEC Chief Accountant. Special thanks to Chairman Doty and Steve for inviting us today. We're extremely excited about continuing our collaborative relationship with the board and look forward to the discussion today. I think there is much that can be done to improve the system that we operate in.
Good morning. I'm Gus Sauter. I'm Chief Investment Officer of the Vanguard Group. I'm excited to be a member of the IAG, representing 10 million investors for whom we invest money, and very interested in the outcome here because it's very important to us to be able to invest that money well.
Good morning. I'm Ann Simpson. I'm Senior Portfolio Manager at CalPERS, which is the largest public fund. Thank you for inviting us to participate in this group. CalPERS lost something in the order of $70 billion because of the crisis. And those companies at the heart of it all had clean accounts, and auditors' reports were almost identical. And the price was rising of the audit, and there were lots of initiatives to try to improve the quality. So we really don't feel we've got to the bottom of this, and it's very important that this group is willing to go right back to basics, look at some of the international debates, and not just think that we're tinkering around business as usual. This is terribly important. And to think about the impact of what went wrong. For a fund like CalPERS, the difference in that financial crisis was dropping from 75 cents on the dollar being paid to pensions out of investment returns down to about 63%. And when we're looking at how important it is that that money's there for people's, ordinary people's daily income, this isn't some technical debate for an ivory tower. It really affects ordinary people's lives and the performance of companies and their pension benefits security. So we think this work is extremely important. Part of the trick will be to make what's technical be a little more comprehensible, but we're very glad to be part of the debate, and thank you for the invitation.
Thank you, and let me give you a very brief update since our last meeting. On May 4th, under the leadership of Acting Chairman Dan Gelter, the board has taken up, in close cooperation with the SEC, a number of recommendations made by you, the Investor Advisory Group, at that time. You asked that the board redouble its efforts to obtain access to foreign registered accounting firms for the purpose of conducting inspections. And in January, our efforts resulted in a cooperative agreement with the United Kingdom. You also asked the board to consider providing investors with the names of issuer clients of PCOB-registered firms in jurisdictions where the PCOB is denied access to conduct inspections. And on May 18, 2010, the PCOB published such a list on its website. You wanted the board to issue timely guidance on hot issues for auditors and boards of directors, and since the May meeting, the board and its staff have published two staff audit alerts, one on the principal auditor's use of the work of foreign auditors, particularly in the China region, and one on the audit implications of breakdowns in the mortgage foreclosure process. In addition, the board adopted 8 new auditing standards, proposed an additional auditing standard, issued a concept release on the failure to supervise provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and proposed 2 rules related to our new authority over audits of brokers and dealers. You asked that the board study and report on lessons learned from the financial crisis, and in September of last year, we published such a report, our 4010 report on the lessons learned from the economic crisis, and we will continue that discussion today. And you asked us to consider whether there should be changes to the auditor's report. And under Dan's leadership and that of our chief auditor, Marty Bauman, we have begun that effort in earnest. And in fact, as shown in the standard-setting agenda found on our website, Chairman Doty, Marty and his staff are planning to update the board on the results of their research by the end of this month, issue a concept release for public comment sometime during the second quarter, hold a roundtable during the third quarter, and issue a proposed standard during the first quarter of 2012. So clearly, the recommendations of this group have made a difference and helped the board to establish our priorities. That is also why the specific topics that will be discussed today have been identified by the advisory group members rather than by the PCAOB. These topics go directly to maintaining investor confidence in the reports issued by the PCAOB registered auditors, and we will be considering them in the following order. First, the auditor's report and the role of the auditor. Second, the lessons learned from the financial crisis. And third, the global networks and audit firm governance. These issues are particularly topical in light of the current debate taking place internationally, as Ann, you referred. The current debate started in 2008 with the deliberations and recommendations of the United States Treasury Advisory Committee on the auditing profession, with many of the issues being carried into subsequent studies and reports, such as the European Commission's Green Paper and the Financial Reporting Council's report on enhancing corporate reporting and audits. What virtually all parties to the debate agree upon is that the status quo is not an option for the auditing world. These identical words, quote, "the status quo is not an option," have been used both by leaders of the accounting and audit profession here in the United States and Michael Barnier, the Commissioner for the Internal Market and Services at the European Commission. Each discussion today will begin with a presentation by the working group that has been researching and considering the topic. After the presentation, the working group will lead a discussion among all investor advisory group members. As I mentioned, unlike board meetings with other advisory groups, this group developed these discussion topics, not the PCAOB staff, and as such, the members will present each topic. At the end of the day, there will be an opportunity for each member to bring up additional topics or issues that were not discussed during one of the day's panels. Also, I would like to note that today's meeting is being webcast. Since we would like the open discussions to be informal and free-flowing, please do not feel as though you have to be recognized to speak. We would ask, however, that for the benefit of those listening to the webcast and for the transcript, you identify yourself the first time you speak and periodically throughout the day. This meeting is open to the public, and information connected with the working group's presentations will be posted on the board's website. Now, to start the program, and knowing that some may be in and out during the course of the day, I would ask Barbara Roper and Lynn Turner to outline very briefly, taking 5 minutes or so, the topics they will be discussing later in the session. And then we go to the full presentation of the panel on the audit report. But before doing that, I will also want to recognize Damon Silvers for 3 minutes or so, because I know, Damon, you got an engagement at the White House this morning, and you'll be testifying this afternoon on the Hill. So we want to give you a little bit of time to give the overlay of what you would have to say. So with that, Barbara, why don't you open it up?
Great. See, thanks to Brandon, I'm feeling better already. My working group was devoted to the lessons learned from the financial crisis. And if we had indeed focused on lessons learned as opposed to lessons that should have been learned, we'd have had a very narrow mandate indeed. Because 2.5 years after dozens of the world's leading financial institutions failed or were prevented by failure from failing only by dint of a massive government intervention, we actually know very little about why these institutions failed without a hint on the financial statements that anything might be wrong. Congress did not deal with these issues when it adopted the legislation and had the Dodd-Frank Act debate, which is probably just as well, because to the degree that they paid any attention to these issues, it was to undermine the independence of the accounting standard-setting process and to weaken protections against fraud at small public companies. The FCIC, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report, does actually have a fair amount of very interesting information in it that deals with the lack of transparency on financial institution balance sheets. But it is focused more on problems with the financial reporting by these institutions than on the auditor's role in that financial reporting. And as Steve indicated, the PCAOB has done some initial and very useful study of some of the problems that occurred with audits that may have contributed to those failures, but it has looked more at, you know, sort of a broad look at what went wrong rather than a focused look at why they went wrong, why things went wrong, and what we might want to do about it. So we haven't seen in this area of the financial reporting and the audits of these financial institutions the kind of detailed accounting that we would like to see of why the auditors, frankly, failed so miserably to fulfill their public watchdog function. You know, nearly a decade ago, Congress passed sweeping legislation, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, that was supposed to solve this problem. You know, it was supposed to make auditors more independent. It was supposed to make them more responsive to shareholders. It was supposed to raise the standards of the audits. It was supposed to hold auditors accountable for doing better audits. It was supposed to fix the very problems that we've just been dealing with in the financial crisis. And so, as I say, the question that we have is, why? You know, why, after all of that effort went into reforming this process, are we still back in a situation where financial statements told investors nothing that they wanted to know about the true health of these financial institutions, and where auditors have shown every sign in this crisis that they continue to view themselves as working for management, and that they continue to see their job as finding a way to get comfortable with management's numbers rather than ensuring that shareholders, investors, get a full and fair picture of the financial state of the public companies. You know, auditors tell us that this is an expectations gap. Investors ask, if this is really the best we can expect, is the audit even relevant anymore? So as I say, our group focused on this question of the need to get a better sense of what went wrong in the crisis. There are doubtless many answers to that, and the EU and UK have started to look at some detail about at those issues. But in this country, at least, so far, we have not seen that kind of detailed examination. And so our first recommendation to the board is that it really needs to undertake this job. It needs to conduct a detailed, transparent, in-depth examination of the role of auditors in the financial crisis, and that needs to look at what went wrong with the audits of these major financial institutions, why the problems occurred, and what can and should be done about it. And, you know, we have ideas about some of the areas that the board would look at, but rather than sort of predetermine what that study should look at, we think it really needs to be thought through in a fairly comprehensive way as we go forward. And then beyond that, you know, that's sort of for where we are now, but we also think this is a process that the board needs to institutionalize. In other words, this examination of audit failures needs to be something that the board does on an ongoing basis in the future, so that you create a process in which you have a very timely mechanism for looking at where the weaknesses in the system are and correcting them. So that, in a nutshell, is our...
Well, Barbara, we look forward to the full presentation a little bit later on.
Lynn, why don't you go ahead now and give an overview of what you'll be presenting later on.
Thank you, Steve. Certainly, the performance of audits has added to the credibility of the information coming out. The auditing profession did seem to have hit a low point coming out of the corporate scandals of the Enrons and WorldComs, Adelphias of the world, if you will, and seemed to be making some progress coming out of that and with the establishment of the PCAOB to improve their audit quality, and I think the board deserves some credit with respect to their inspections in that regards. But in recent years, it seems that instead of moving forward, the profession seems to be moving backwards in a number of areas. We see them. We see the type of things that Barbara talked about in terms of lack of red flags, perhaps lack of credible reports on controls. We see the firms once again growing their consulting practices all over again, and We've seen in the past how when that happens, the tail seems to become the dog in terms of driving the mentality within the profession. And there's three of us around the table here, and Jürger, Damon, and myself, who spent over a year working on the U.S. Treasury Committee on report on the auditing profession, which included a number of hearings, public hearings, quite a substantial public comment period, public comment, a couple of exposure drafts, and it included a wide variety of people on that board, investors, people from the firms, representatives from the business community, regulators, et cetera. And it's now been 2.5 years since that report came out. Some of their recommendations, such as improvements to the communication between the auditors and investors, were not necessarily new. Those same type of recommendations were made back in the 70s and unfortunately weren't acted upon. And if they had been acted upon in a timely manner, and perhaps if some of the recommendations in the Treasury Committee had reported been in place prior to when we went into this crisis, perhaps investors, and hopefully investors, would have gotten red flags that they could have acted upon. And clearly, the markets are only efficient and can only be efficient if they get adequate information. As we've seen in recent years, they haven't gotten the information, and as a result, the markets have been woefully inadequate. Our own fund went from our members in our fund, about 500,000 people in Colorado, about 15% of the population, watched as their investment accounts went from an aggregate of about $44 billion down to about $26 billion during this crisis, which had significant impact on them as well as our taxpayers. So it is a very significant issue. At the same time, many people watched as their 401ks of Vanguard or Fidelity or whatever went go through exactly the same type of crisis. So we do think in our subcommittee, and there's a memo that we've prepared that's in your materials that give you greater detail, that it is time to finally act upon all those recommendations of the Treasury Committee report. This was an esteemed group of people led by former SEC Chairman Arthur Levitt and former SEC Chief Accountant Don Nicolaisen. but some of those recommendations included in the area of transparency and governance, which we've all embraced for public companies around the globe. We've embraced for greater transparency in government agencies as well. The one place that we don't seem to be able to get it is in these large accounting firms. And we've seen the benefits of it in the operations and efficiency of other organizations, and one has to ask, why is it that this one group seems to be isolated from the benefits of that that other organizations have seen? So certainly it's time for them to become much more transparent in terms of their financials, in terms of their governance. It's time for, as Dan Gelser has most appropriately called for, greater transparency at the PCAOB with respect to the investigations in that entire process, taking it back to what the SEC adopted, quite frankly, Chairman Shapiro, while you were there as a commissioner when the commission voted to make public all the 102E proceedings. And as I recall, briefing with you on that, you're a very positive supporter of that. there's also the issue with the increasing slide back into the consulting with respect to the independence of the audit firms. And the coziness of these firms, we've seen in a number of these cases, the audit firm had been with that company for decades. GAO report has also pointed out that that relationship has gone on for decades at other organizations, and in light of some of the situations we've seen reported in the press, it just raises the question as to whether still in the mind of the auditor, keeping those audit fees were more important than getting the right answer out, something we also saw with respect to the credit rating agency. So it's not something that just afflicted the auditors, but as we made changes with the credit rating agencies, it seems that it's time to make change and a fundamental change. We discussed this at during the course of the ACAP report, the Treasury Committee. In fact, Paul Volcker was a very strong proponent of doing and acting on something like this. The chairs had chosen, after discussions with the firms, not to act on that. But I think it is now time to act on that. I think it's time to revisit the whole issue of mandatory rotation. And I think using a reasonable period for rotation, the time for that is past due now. And that was very key to some members on our subcommittee. Global audit quality, you've mentioned the problems with the Chinese audits. I think Chairman Doty is absolutely direct on target with that. Business has become much more global. If you look at the financial reports of companies such as IBM, Coca-Cola, and General Electric, the majority of their operations and their revenues come from outside the U.S. Those audits of those numbers are conducted by firms, affiliates outside the U.S. There are separate legal entities from the firm here. Yet over the years as that globalization has occurred, we have not changed fundamentally how we supervise and oversee those portion of the audits. And for many years, the firms have relied upon credentialing, where essentially if you had an affiliate and the partner was credentialed over in his own country, they pretty much went and did that portion of the audit without the type of supervision that you'd see being conducted here in the U.S. on the U.S. portion of the audit. I think it's time to revisit credentialing. I think it's time to revisit the supervision and how that is done. We've certainly seen problems with that with respect to Chinese audits, and I think it's past due time to revisit in its totality here and reconsider those standards. Chairman Shapiro, in her opening remarks, noted that perhaps it's time to redo standards. I think this is one standard that it's more than past due time to reconsider and change.
Lynn, I'm going to have to cut you off because I want to watch the clock very carefully, and we got your full presentation a little bit
later.
That's
fine, Steve.
And I know, Damon, you know, I can't understand why we don't preempt the White House and the Hill, but since clearly we don't in your mind, why don't you take your three minutes or so, and then we'll excuse you.
Steve, thank you. I was going to say something to the effect of, you know, there are very few powers on this earth that would take me away from this committee, but you named two of them. I hope it will hearten folks around the table that one of the things that I'm doing on the Hill, it's testifying with respect to changes and proposed changes to Dodd-Frank, some of which I think go right to the issues we're discussing here today. Try to be very brief here. And first, thank you for giving me the chance to speak a little bit out of turn. As I said before, I'm Damon Silvers. I'm the policy director of the AFL-CIO. I am here because of the interaction between our capital markets, our system of public accounting and public auditing, and the retirement security of working Americans. I think it's fair to say that we are our country is in a profound long-term retirement security crisis. The problems we've had in our financial markets over the last decade or more, repeated bubbles, repeated sort of crises in governance, disclosure, enforcement, regulation, are not the cause of our retirement security crisis, but they've exacerbated it profoundly. And we've heard, I think, from a number of other people in this room about the specific numbers at specific plans in terms of losses. I think that's people in this room, Chairman Shapiro, Chairman Doty, you all are in the position of having, for different reasons and in different ways, having to rebuild and restore both the strength and the public confidence in our financial regulatory institutions. And it's a great honor to be here with you because of the work. I know that, Jim, you're just beginning, and I know we've talked about it, and I have great confidence in where you're taking the board and the great work, Mary, that you have done. But these are profound challenges. This meeting today, you've heard, I think, the presentations from my colleagues on, I think, these two very sort of overarching issues for this group and for the PCAOB, the question of both understanding and there being some accountability for the events of the last several years in the financial markets, and I think it's important to emphasize those events are continuing. This is not the matter that is over. It is as present as this week's headlines about irregularities in the mortgage markets, all of which have implications for the work of this board. This question of accountability, one, and the question, two, of the set of issues around the current present performance and future of the auditing profession that Lynn alluded to. Now, I just want to say before I have to leave that I'm extremely impressed and supportive of both the presentations that you'll see later in detail that you just heard summarized. And I want to say a word or two about this issue of understanding and accounting for, in a sense, the financial crisis and the role of the audit process and of public company auditors in respect to that crisis. The PCAOB, despite being in a very awkward position as a result of the Supreme Court litigation, is one of the very few institutions, other than those that were specifically ordered to do so, like the FCIC, one of the very few institutions in our government or around our government that has tried to do some kind of inquiry report on the what happened in relation to its obligations in the financial crisis. But I think, and so the board, the staff deserve a lot of credit, but I think fundamentally the question that got asked got it backwards. The key issue is not the impact of the crisis on audits, although that's not a non-issue. The real issue is the question of the impact of the audits on the crisis. And there's a profound conundrum, and I'm going to quote to you from a little piece of the presentation you're going to hear. The Center for Audit Quality, which I respect greatly, many friends who work there and are involved in that body, said that, "We believe that auditors generally carried out their role effectively during the crisis and appropriately reached audit opinions within the context of the applicable accounting and auditing frameworks." I don't have enough information to judge whether that statement is true or not, but it seems to me it's almost equally disturbing if it's true than if it's false. Right? Because the question is, how could we possibly say that we have an adequate auditing framework if that outcome could occur? And so I think that question is the question that the PCAOB really needs to dig into and dig into deeply. And I think there are a couple of also further questions. I'll note that some of you may know this. I serve on the vice chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel for TARP. That body is issuing its final report today, and we go out of business, leaving me more time for the PCAOB and other things. But in the context of that work, it's become apparent to me, and I've raised this issue repeatedly here at the SAG, that they're just basic unanswered questions, such as, I'll just mention two of them. What were auditors supposed to have done around the question of going concern during the financial crisis? And in particular, what were they supposed to have done around firms who would have had a going concern problem but for government guarantees, particularly implicit ones? I mean, I think we know something about the GSEs, for example, but what about Citigroup and Bank of America and Goldman Sachs? Secondly, and I've alluded to this earlier, there are these continuing and profound issues about the valuation, accounting, and auditing of mortgage-related assets. Our oversight panel could not divine what an appropriate valuation was of troubled assets more than a year into the TARP program because the financial accounting for those assets was so opaque, and auditors signed off on all those statements. This is in our August 2009 oversight report. That problem seems pretty significant, but it's not been compounded by, I think, all the issues associated with the mortgage processing irregularities that are on the front pages this week. These are enormous questions, and no one has answered them. The board will have before it this afternoon, as a result of my colleagues' work, detailed presentations on these issues, and they completely reflect my views and concerns. And I'll finally say, and close, that as a result of the work of the Treasury Committee that Lynn talked about, there is a menu of suggestions for how to, at minimal levels, because they don't reflect the events of the last 36 months, a set of basic ideas for how to improve the independence and accountability and transparency of the public company audit process. Items like audit financial statements for audit firms, potentially outside directors, auditor rotation, and the like. I can't resist, in the context of Jay Hansen's comment, that auditors don't hear from investors enough. that one thing that's been sitting in front of the PCAOB for a while that might help that is for an actual human being to sign the audit statement. Be easy, much easier for that person to hear from investors if investors who knew who that person was. And so with that, I'll close, and I thank you for the opportunity to say a word or two.
And now, Joe, we'll get on with our first presentation, which relates to possible revisions to the auditor's report and an examination of the role of the auditor in today's securities markets. The working group looking at these issues is led by Professor Joe Carcella and includes Brandon Becker, Norman Harrison, Pete Nakway, Gus Sauter, and Ann Yerger. And others participating with this group included Ann Simpson, Bonnie Hill, and Mike Head. And while Pete, Bonnie, and Mike could not be here, it's my understanding that their views and those of Eric Vinson are incorporated in Joe's presentation. So, Joe, take it away.
Thanks, Steve. And let me thank again the board for convening this group, and Chairman Shapiro and Jim and Mike and Brian. Brian, there's a seat over here if you want to. No? Okay. For being here. The involvement of the SEC, I think, sends a real important signal. One of the things we've done that we'll talk about is we actually did a survey to gather data on what investors value. So it's not just our opinion. So let me go ahead and hand out the actual survey so that when we get to that, watch me tripping, you'll have that in front of you. And then I think there probably is enough copies, if not for everybody in the room, close to everybody in the room. And then we also have a PDF of the question-by-question results, so you can have that in front of you as well. All right. So our charge, and Jim or Jay, if I am blocking you, you can't see, just let me know. To look at the auditor's report. And we have a subgroup of the IAG. In addition to myself, Norman Harrison is going to be involved from Breeden in presenting, Gus Sauter from Vanguard, and Ann Yerger from the Council of Institutional Investors. In addition, Brandon Becker from TIAA CREF was involved in our subgroup, and Ann Simpson from CalPERS was involved in our subgroup, from the people who are here today and then some people who aren't here. The first known written U.S. corporate audit report was a report by the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Company in 1827, and it talks about essentially just an audit of receipts and disbursements and talks about the accounts being correct. So you can see we've gone a long way in the last 170 years or so. As the audit report has evolved over the years, the first audit report, as I said, simply stated the findings of an accounting examination. It's cash in, essentially cash out. In the early 1900s, audit reports were very detailed and descriptive, provided a comprehensive examination of what the auditors did. The audit report was seen as a certification as to the accuracy of the numbers. And there wasn't a standard audit report until 1917, when there was a Federal Reserve bulletin on the topic. Over the years, there's been a lot of interest in this topic and different commissions that have examined the topic. So the Cohen Commission back in 1978 looked at this, recommended that the auditor's work should be clearly described and their findings should be clearly described without using technical terminology, describe the audit function unambiguously, state the limitations of the audit function, and use standardized alternative phrases rather than a single standard report form. More recently, the CFA Institute has done surveys similar to what we've done on what investors want. Based on the CFA survey, they want more specific information about how auditors reach their opinion, more information about key risk areas, about significant changes in those risk areas, and about areas that require judgment and involve uncertainty. Earlier today, we've heard from Barbara and Lynn and Damon about the ACAP committee. The ACAP committee made a number of recommendations. One would be to clarify the auditor's role and limitations in detecting fraud, consider mandating the partner's signature on the auditor's report, and consider making the report more descriptive. So let's look at the world in 1990 and the world today. Why did I pick 1990? The last time there were any degree of substantive change to the audit report, at least by the profession, was as part of the expectation gap standards. Okay, and so you go back and you read SAS 58 and SAS 59, you know, those fun pieces of literature, and that was really the most recent change, and I'll leave it to people who are more familiar with this in the audience as to whether that was significant change or not. It was a change, whether or not it was really substantive. It's debatable, but it was a change. So let's pick 1990, and let's pick today. And let's look at our world, okay? And so I have technology products up there, and they've changed a lot, right? There are whole new industries that exist today that didn't exist 20 years ago. The accounting profession has changed. Arguably, the firm's organizational structure has changed more than their product. And countries have changed. The largest country in the world, at least in terms of land size, 20 years ago, has now been split into smaller pieces. So let's see how the product we care about, the auditor's report, has changed in the last 20 years. So what I have up here is an audit report, and you have these slides in front of you, so you probably can't read this, but you have the slides in front of you, issued in February of 1996 by the Ernst & Young on the B.F. Goodrich Company. Okay? Audit report issued by Ernst & Young on the B.F. Goodrich Company today. Okay? Now, what I've highlighted here for you is the same company. So we've held the company constant. The only thing that's changed in 15 years is highlighted. So there's now a reference to the standards of you, the PCAOB, and there's a reference to the 404 audit. Those changes were mandated by the United States Congress. So short of changes mandated by the United States Congress, arguably we would have seen exactly the same audit report 15 years later. So I think it's reasonable to make a supposition, right? Given the lack of change in the product, customers, i.e. investors, because if investors aren't the customer, why do you exist, must love the product. Norman will provide empirical evidence on the truth of that supposition later. Okay, so when we came together as a group, again, the group is Brandon from TIAA CREF, me, Norman from Breeden, Mike Head from TD Ameritrade, Bonnie Hill, who's on a bunch of corporate audit committees, Icon Blue, Pete Natchway, who's the CFO at Legg Mason, Gus from Vanguard, Ann Simpson from CalPERS, Eric Vinson, who's a hedge fund manager at Osprey, and Ann Yerger at the council. We came together, and one of the decisions we made very early is we did not want this to be the opinion of however many people they are, six wise men and women. We wanted it to be more broadly than that. And we also wanted it to be driven not just by quote-unquote investor advocates, but by people who every day are buying and selling equity and debt securities, trillions of dollars of equity and debt securities. So we made an effort to reach out to investors. And we were fortunate, and we had some help from BlackRock, which is the largest money management firm in the United States. We also wanted this to be as mainline corporate America as possible, to insulate against any criticism that we were driven by special interests. And we also had good help from Capital Group. So let's think about what we have here. The largest money manager in the country, Vanguard, the largest mutual fund in the country, Capital Group, the third largest mutual fund in the country. I'll say more about that in a little while. We also developed, so the people on the subgroup, we put together the survey with a lot of involvement from the people on the subgroup. I asked those individuals to get 3 to 5 people inside their organizations who buy and sell daily to fill out the questionnaire. And then we also developed a mailing list of 300 large investment banks, hedge funds, private equity funds, mutual funds, pension funds, and endowments, and we mailed to them. So we have a mix of kind of a choice-based sample and a random sample, because we just wanted as much feedback as we could get. We had respondents included CEOs of some of these organizations, presidents, managing directors, CFOs, chief investment officers, equity analysts, portfolio managers, controllers, and credit analysts. So that's kind of a sense of who responded. The survey, as you can see, it's in front of you. We started off with just project background and instructions. We had some baseline information on the current use of the audit report and the value that users feel they get from the audit report and potential changes that they would like to see. Then we broke the actual body of the survey into 3 sections. One would be, what additional information, if any, do investors want about the audit process itself? What did the auditor do? We asked them if they wanted additional information about what the auditor found, and then we asked them if they wanted the form of the report itself, structure of the report, to change. And then we tried to gather basic demographic information on the employer and the title of the person. So the responses received, it's hard to get people's attention in today's world, but we got 73 respondents, and we did receive multiple responses from BlackRock, 7, and as I said, $3.6 trillion of assets under management, Vanguard, 6, and 1.4, Capital Group, TIAA, Kreft, Legg Mason, Breeding Capital. Just those groups alone represent more than $7 trillion of assets under management. And in addition, we had responses. This is just a sampling. Highbridge Capital Management, Pershing Square, Osprey, the Virginia Retirement System, the Florida State Board of Administration, CalPERS, and a number of others. So that's a little bit about how we went about this, how we gathered, what the survey looks like, what the respondents looks like. And Norman, who's in back of me, is going to take it into our next section.
After many years of public speaking in different contexts, never to follow the professor to the microphone, but I haven't learned that lesson. Am I off?
Is that okay?
Yeah. Try this.
Okay.
The first set of questions we asked were designed to set some parameters. I think when you're surveying a population, in this case, population of users of financial statements, about possible changes to the audit format of the auditor's report, the first question you ought to ask is whether users are satisfied with the status quo. Does the current report give you sufficient information? Do you find it a valuable tool? So that's the first question we asked. And not surprisingly, perhaps, most of our respondents told us that they do not believe that the current format of the audit report provides valuable information to them in their work as investors. It's important to understand as you read these results. You have the detailed survey results in front of you, but for purposes of summarizing the responses, we have included or attributed percentages only to the population of the respondents who actually expressed a point of view. There are five potential responses to each question, as you see. You could strongly disagree, be neutral, express no view, or agree or strongly agree. So the percentages we show here are only for the portions of the respondents in each case who expressed an opinion. So here, for example, 45% of the respondents told us they believe that the survey doesn't, the current audit report does not provide valuable information to facilitate their understanding of the financial statements. It's important to understand, though, however, that only 68% of the people who responded to this question had an opinion one way or the other. The rest were neutral or hadn't reflected on the issue. So of those who had a view, well over two-thirds were of the view that the current format of the audit report is not helpful to them in their work. 73% told us they skimmed the report quickly. And I hear this all the time in my work and discussions with colleagues and discussions with clients and in former lives with colleagues in the investment industry. Many are of the view that even calling this four-paragraph letter a report is a bit of glorifies it beyond what it really is, that it's nothing more than a transmittal letter or a check of the box and doesn't provide really any insight to investors as to what they're going to find in the financial statements that follow. And we get a sense of that through some of the narrative commentary, which was very helpful. I think one of the very, very useful features of this survey that Joe principally designed is that it provided our respondents a chance to give us not only a graded answer to a question, but narrative input. A lot of the comments are very, very helpful and shed some further light on these issues. The comments here, in each case by a portfolio manager or an investment professional at a large institutional money manager, tell us what we all hear a lot, I think what I certainly do in my dealings with investment professionals, and that is the audit report really is nothing but boilerplate. It's canned language. I sometimes count the paragraphs. If it's the right number of paragraphs, I keep going. If I don't see the words going concern jumping off the page at me, then that's really all that it does, which from an investment professional standpoint very, very often means very little. It's a pass-fail model. It's binary, yes, no, and that's it. Interestingly, however, there is another category of respondents that had a somewhat different view. We received responses in some cases from individuals who sit on the audit committees of mutual funds. And in this case, you see a different point of view expressed. Audit committee members in general tended to take the view that, well, yes, the auditor's report is one of the tiles in this mosaic that we look at and consider when we're getting comfort with the disclosures that our fund is providing. And it's interesting that those who have more of an actual relationship with the auditor, people who are responsible for retaining and overseeing the work of and regularly interacting with the auditor, attached greater significance to the auditor's report than the investment professionals who are actually on the front lines using the financial statements as raw data for the analytical investment process. We may talk about this more later in the Q&A session. There are other areas in which there are somewhat significant disparities in responses to our survey between investment professionals, people who actually go to work each day, crunch numbers, make investment decisions, or recommend investment decisions to the investment committees of their funds on the one hand, and people like audit committee members who are more involved in oversight and governance functions. There are some interesting departures, disparities in responses that we may take a minute to reflect on. Far and away, the area in which our respondents most overwhelmingly agreed that further disclosure or some form of disclosure in the audit report would be very helpful in the investment process comes in the area of disclosures of risks, which again intuitively makes sense because if you think about it, what all of us do who are in the investment business is we analyze financial information and assign, attribute risks to the quality of the reporting, to the projections, to management's own disclosures, to the models we build to assign a value to a company, projecting future results and choosing an appropriate discount rate, the range of discount rates to apply to those earnings to try to derive some sense of a current value to determine whether a stock we believe is perhaps undervalued in the market all of those functions, those day-to-day investment functions, involve assigning, attributing levels of risk and factoring risk into the investment process, the analytical process behind investment decision making. So here our respondents most overwhelmingly said that the auditor's report in some manner provided a narrative description of those areas of disclosure, those areas in the financial statements where the auditor saw relatively greater levels of risk. We would find that type of disclosure to be important. We would also like to know, for those areas of greater risk in the presentation of financial results, what additional resources did the auditor apply? Was there an expansion in the scope of the audit, an assignment of specialist resources to the audit firm? What did the auditor do in response to perceived areas of relatively high risk or significant risk in the issuer's financial reports? The next question was a question of disclosure around the allocation of audit firm resources to different aspects of the audit. And we asked specifically whether investors would find it useful to know the number of hours and the allocation of hours spent by the audit team on certain categories of the financial statements or accounts. And for the most part, the answer here was no, not really. Some expressed a view that it would be interesting to know, that it would perhaps be beneficial in some respects. But I think the consensus of the responses here was that allocation of individuals and the tallying of hours spent on various elements of the financial disclosure doesn't necessarily correlate with those areas of greatest risk or substantive significance. The labor-intensive nature of an audit task is not necessarily correlated with risk. Another area, however, where there was significant agreement among our audit respondents was in the category of potential disclosure by the auditor of the materiality thresholds that the audit firm applied in its review of the financial statements. Again, 56% expressed a positive view here, but we received, other than a neutral response to this question, from 73% of the people who answered the question. So the 56% is actually a substantial majority of those who took a view one way or the other. There was a lot of discussion around this. I think this is an area where the narrative discussion will shed some further light on the issue. Interestingly, one of the participants, an investment professional from one of the mutual funds we surveyed, actually didn't take issue with the concept or the proposition that there should be more disclosure around the issue of materiality thresholds, both quantitative and qualitative. But rather than have it be a matter of disclosure on an audit-by-audit basis or a firm-by-firm basis, believe that it should be the subject of a more broad-based standard-setting initiative, perhaps by the SEC or the FASB. Next category in terms of overall sort of background presentation that we asked about was whether investors would find it useful to know the nature of, the extent of work performed by firms other than the audit firm signing the audit report. And again, here we had a fairly overwhelming response. It wasn't one of the questions where everyone had a view. 67% of the respondents said either yes or no to some degree, but of those that responded, 47 percentage points, or 70% of the total respondents to this question, said that they would find it useful to know situations in which other audit firms, including non-U.S. member firms of the U.S. firm signing the opinion, were participants in the audit. I think the issue here is one of level of confidence in the overall audit process and at least wanting to know, again, from a risk measurement standpoint, evaluating risks associated with the audit, whether there was substantial participation by firms or affiliate of firms who are beyond the scope of PCAOB and SEC oversight. So those were the threshold questions. And again, just to summarize briefly, far and away the two areas in which our survey respondents told us they would find it extremely useful to have substantive narrative disclosure or discussion by the auditor pertains to the areas of risk, identification of areas of risk in the issuer's financial statements where the greatest levels of risk appear, and knowing something more about what the audit firm did to audit and test and evaluate those risks. And secondly, some definition around the both the qualitative and the quantitative measures of materiality that were used with respect to particular items or elements of financial statement disclosure. Again, there was also a high level of interest in knowing more about participation by other audit firms who were not the firm signing the opinion. And the only area in which there was relatively little interest compared to the other areas is on the question of disclosure of allocation of resources and hours spent on the various elements of the audit. So that, again, these are the threshold areas. We move on now to the discussion of the survey, portions of the survey, which questioned our respondents on what more they would like to know about how the audit was conducted, and what more they would like to see in terms of manner of disclosure of the findings and the results of the audit. And Gus and Ann will take you through those two areas.
And Gus, why don't you, Gus, why don't you say at the outset how much Vanguard has under management?
Okay, I'm Gus Sauter from Vanguard, and Joe was close. We have about $1.7 trillion under management in around the world, about $1.6 trillion in U.S. mutual funds. So I'm going to discuss I'll be discussing what the auditors found. Norma just talked about what the auditors did. The first question we asked in this section was the evaluation of significant estimates and judgments. And here, 79%, an overwhelming supermajority of respondents believe that the auditor should discuss significant estimates and judgments made by the management. I personally strongly agree with this. I would liken this to the difference between a physicist and a statistician. A physicist is very hard mathematics, believe in single point estimates, and I would distinguish that from a statistician who believes there's a distribution of outcomes. And when we look at financial statements, we get a single point estimate. We get the physicist's view of what the world looks like. Unfortunately, we recognize that many of these numbers have a broad band of around them, that they are in fact estimates. And so I believe that we need information that a statistician would look at here. And so including this in an audit report, the fact that there are estimates and judgments and what those estimates and judgments are is very important. I would note that there is a comment here that that is the job of management. I don't disagree that that's the job of management. It's perhaps not fair to debate somebody who's not here, but I do find I'm more successful in debates that way. But I do believe that the financial statements and the audit report are created for the benefit of investors, not for management. They're really not. They're useful statements for management, certainly to help them better manage the company. But ultimately, they are created for investors, and this is, I think, very valuable information that we would love to have. Second question we asked in this section was about evaluation of accounting policies and practices. And again, a large majority of investors or of the respondents indicated that they believe the auditor should discuss the quality of the accounting policies and the practices, not just the acceptability. So we know there are many ways to create financial statements within the auspices of GAAP accounting, but some of them may better reflect what's really going on in the company than others. And so it's important for the audit report, to indicate how well the types of policies chosen by management to represent the company really do represent the financials of the company, and how consistently those were applied. Another, for me, very important question is the sensitivity analysis performed by the audit engagement team. So 65%, another, again, there was a strong agreement throughout this entire section of questions. 65% would like the auditor to include the results of the sensitivity analysis in significant areas of judgment. This ties into one of the questions that Norman was talking about the risk of the audit. What parts of the audit represent greater risk than others? What can we learn from doing sensitivity analysis? And I think actually there's a very good example with the global financial crisis that transparency actually can lead to higher valuations of stocks rather than lower, that this doesn't represent risk to management or to the company, that it actually can represent value to management and certainly value to investors. And, I would just point to the stress tests that were done on the banks. Those stress tests came out, I believe, in April of 2009. The market bottomed in March of 2009, and it largely bottomed with the knowledge that the stress tests were going quite well and would be quite positive. So, in fact, stress tests in the case of the banking system really proved to be a very positive thing, and valuations started to rise from there. So removing uncertainty is a very important principle with investing. Next question was disclose unusual transactions and restatements and other significant changes. And yet again, 67% believe that the auditor should disclose unusual transactions, restatements, and significant changes. The Kahn comment says that management should do all of this, and much of this should be done by management. But I think it's important. The way I think of the auditor's report is, to me, it's an executive summary or an abstract. And to me, it should be giving us a little bit of a roadmap as investors as to what we should be focusing on. What are key areas that we should know about and look for inside the financials? So this would be important information to know that there was something unusual, something to not ignore, something to track down. And then I believe the final question here is, disclose the key issues discussed in the summary audit memorandum. And here, 54% believe that the auditor should discuss key issues in the summary audit memorandum, and 18% did disagree. If I were to rank all of the things that we surveyed here, quite honestly, giving you my candid opinion, I pretty much agree with the top of the comment here, only if issues were not resolved. So, yes, it'd be important if their issues are not resolved, but discussing, in my personal view and that of Vanguard, to discuss issues that were resolved and that the auditor felt comfortable with would be of less importance to me. I recognize that we can't, that in fact, if we put everything into an audit report that we're surveying here, the audit report would be as thick as the prospectus, and we know that very few investors read a prospectus, which is the advantage of a summary prospectus. So really observing the principle of parsimony, I think this one to me falls down a little bit lower on my list of priorities. But here is a summary of all of the questions in this particular section, and you can see large agreement in most of these questions, very, very strong agreement, most significant being the assessment of the issuer's estimates and judgments. Second, representing Vanguard's views and my personal views, I would say that is the most important thing to me that should be included in an auditor's report. The second question was discussion of unusual transactions and restatements. And to me, that if I were ranking these myself, that would be third for me. So very important, again, assessment of quality of issuers' accounting policies and practices, strong agreement there. My second favorite would be the next one, the discussion of sensitivity analyses, as I mentioned before, doing stress tests. And then finally, on the positive side, the discussion of key issues included in the summary audit memorandum. But there were a couple of questions that I did not cover here that were in the survey where really the respondents were somewhat ambivalent toward. The first one was the disclosure of all audit adjustments discussed with management. And there it was 50-50 whether or not people favored that or opposed it. And similarly, grading the issuer's aggressiveness or conservatism in creating the financial statements on a 1-to-point scale, 1-to-10-point scale. And again, this was a 50-50 toss-up. So that's it for this next section, and I will turn to Ann to present the final section.
Good morning, everyone. Given that we're sort of running out of time, I'm going to blow through my slides a bit. I was charged with, oh no, this is why my husband never gives me the remote control. Can I touch a button to get rid of the view? Sorry. I don't want to touch anything now.
You gonna do it?
I won't touch it. Well, let me start. My task is to summarize the survey responses relative to the form of the audit report. Okay, let me just get there really quick. Apologies, everyone. This is going to take up. We have a long slide thing here, don't we? Oh, darn it. Okay. I'm just going to roll through it. I think everyone's got it. It's going to be up on the website. First of all, in terms of the form of the report, the survey did find that there was strong support for reforms to the report. First, two-thirds of the respondents that had an opinion suggested and strongly supported expanding the assurance language in the current auditor's report to expressly state that assurance in terms of whether there's a possible risk, a material risk to the financial statements as to a misstatement, address whether that's caused by an error or fraud. And I know there's been a lot of debate over the years about what's the auditor's role in terms of detecting fraud, and one of the comments on the slide sort of, I think, says it all, which is that auditors should state that they at least looked for material fraud. Second issue was regarding the auditor partner signature, and a slightly less than 60% of the respondents that had an opinion on that issue believe that the audit engagement partner should sign the report. In terms of how should this additional information be presented to investors, I think somewhere north of 70% of the respondents that had an opinion on that believe that there should be a separate auditor discussion and analysis section. So there should not be an expansion of the current report, but instead an additional report that would be provided in the 10-K. Regarding whether there should be disclosure in that report of information provided to the audit committees, again, somewhere north of 70% of those that had an opinion on that issue believed that indeed the report should include at least some narrative summary of issues that have been communicated by the audit firm to the audit committee. Two issues that I'm not going to talk about, but where we found there was sort of less support, first and foremost, was this issue of whether that binary nature, that pass-fail nature of the current report should be changed to be more gradated, whether there should be the allowance for C reports or different grades in the middle. And there actually was a real split within the respondents. So I don't think we didn't find strong support for changing the current kind of pass-fail model of the existing report. And there was also, I think, more opposition, although still support for the concept of greater disclosure about the roles of management versus the auditor in terms of identifying, detecting, and preventing fraud. So I think the key takeaways from the survey are that status quo is no longer appropriate. It's real strong support within the respondents that there should be changes and expansion of the information provided to investors. And I think our view stepping back is that this is the role of the auditor. I know there's a lot of questions about what's the auditor's role here. in terms of costs and benefits, and perhaps we'll talk about that more in the Q&A section. But our belief is that what the survey respondents said they wanted is work that the audit firms are already doing. The question here and the issue is providing more information to investors so that they can do a better job analyzing the quality of the reported financials, understanding where the risks may be with those financial statements, and helping them make a better investment decision. So if I identified the top four issues that came out of the survey, there's just broad support for greater disclosure on the auditor's assessment of management's estimates and judgments and the process that the auditor used to reach that assessment. Second, areas of high risk to the financial statements, and our concern here isn't operational risk. It's concern that the financials may be materially problematic. Third, greater disclosure about unusual transactions, restatements, and other really significant changes. And finally, the quality of the issuer's accounting practices and policies. I think in conclusion, regarding next steps, and I'm only speaking for Joe, Gus, and Norm, Anne and Brandon, we weren't able to talk to you before this, so I don't want to put words in your mouth, but we would very much like to urge the board to methodically but aggressively address this issue and resolve this issue. It's been debated now for 40-plus years. It's under debate around the globe. The fact is that our markets are known for having the highest standards in terms of transparency and quality of information to investors, and we believe there's an opportunity and an important role for the U.S. to lead this discussion of how these reports should be changed. Thank you.
Well, Joe, Norman, and Gus, and Ann, thank you very much. That was clearly showed a terrific amount of work and effort. I will save my questions to the last, preserve myself 5 minutes, if I may, and open it up to Chairman Shapiro or Chairman Doty for any words that they like, and then we'll just open up for questions.
Well, let me just say I'm anxious to hear the discussion, but I actually thought this was just a first-rate presentation, and I agree with Steve. Clearly an enormous amount of work and thought went into it, and I think it will inform the discussion incredibly well. So I really thank you so much for it.
Joe, first a technical point, and it's important, I think, for the board. I think you all adjusted your responses to focus on the people in these organizations who are actually investing the money and to wait away from the individuals who might be giving multiple responses but were involved in other functions. Is that true?
Let's see here.
So the preferences, the point being the preferences that you're summarizing here for us are the ones of the investor decision makers.
Well, you can see it. Maybe you can't see it. Bottom left. Mm-hmm. Okay. As Jim said, and I was able to give Jim an advanced look at this yesterday. As we were thinking about this a little bit deeper, although we contacted only investor organizations, once the questionnaire got there, we had no control over who filled it out. And so we had CFOs, we had controllers, we had board members, we had audit committee members, and not that their opinions don't matter. But I thought it might be interesting to see if only those who are in an investment function, who actually are buying and selling, would evaluate these things differently. And the answer, Jim, is yes, very much so. On every single question, how often do you find that? Okay. Every single question, the investors evaluated the need for change higher than did the overall respondent. So what I've done here is I've taken the issue, summarized it in just a couple of words on the far left column, and then the overall mean in the next column, that's the all respondents, and then the investor only, and then the difference. And what you see, Jim, is that on some things, it's a pretty big difference. Now, you might say, 0.37, 0.36, 0.34 is not that big a difference. It's a 5-point scale. And so some of these differences are pretty noticeable. And so I think two takeaways, again, are that in general, investors want change more than the overall population. And if you look at, you know, the ones that I have in bold are the ones where there was a big change and there seemed to be meaningful support. And I define meaningful support as a mean of 3.5 or higher. So materiality disclosure, risk disclosure. Look at that risk disclosure number, 4.32. That's on a 5-point scale. And that's a very, very high number. Unusual transactions, 4.14. Significant estimates and judgments, sensitivity analyses, quality of accounting policies and practices. The numbers were high when we had the overall respondents. When you limit it, Jim, just to investment professionals, the numbers even go higher.
And to go back to Ann's recommendation to the board, which I take it is the recommendation of the whole committee, which is that we address it methodically but high priority right away. And I may have missed this in Gus's presentation, but how do you all rank the priorities of the matters you'd like to see discussed in light of what you just put up? Where, for example, do sensitivity analyses, discussion of what the auditor did, and what they performed by way of tests, where does that rate in relationship to some of the other issues, and then some kind of overall statement about where the auditor looked for misapplication, fraud?
The four items that Ann finished with, Jim, that last slide, those were the four items on the questionnaire that had the greatest support, both from investors and from all respondents. And we assessed greatest support in two ways. The highest percentage of people who said they wanted this information either agreed or strongly agreed that additional information in those areas would be helpful, as well as the biggest difference between those who supported that information and those who didn't think it would be helpful. So we basically took those who agreed or strongly agreed, compared it to those who disagreed and strongly disagreed, and looked for a magnitude of difference.
I don't want this to appear rehearsed. You said we talked. This is not a rehearsal.
Yeah, no, this isn't rehearsed.
But I do think I take away from what you have said, from what you've all said, that the interest in the investor group is to get the information, to get it in a format that does not cloud or render ambiguous what's been the standard format of a report. The basic structure of what has been the audit report, and that how this information is delivered, in your minds, does not require or does not is not determined by any effort to enhance auditor private civil liability. In other words, you all would be happy with a solution that reaches the results of the Treasury report and the results that your survey rendered. Giving on the Treasury report, if it could be done in a way that did not enhance private civil liability of the audit firm. Is that fair?
Yeah, we've talked about this, and Ann may want to jump in here in a minute, because Ann and I in particular talked about this at some length. And the sense that we have as our subgroup, certainly, and even some of the feedback we got from the questionnaire, this is not an attempt, certainly not by the four of us, in any way to reach for auditors' wallets. This is purely an attempt to have better information, and to the extent it can be done in a way that doesn't increase their legal liability, I think we would all be supportive of that.
Has anybody ever thought about making some of this interactive? Have a day where you ask the auditor, maybe part of the annual meeting or something, where the auditor can be facing the investors and responding to questions, you know, so there could be something more direct rather than having to get some, you just do everything on paper. Is there anything, any of this ever been done? Is there a reason not to do it?
Ann Simpson. Senior Portfolio Manager, CalPERS. In my experience, auditors do attend the annual meeting.
What's that?
In my experience, auditors do come to the annual meeting. And we were week before last at the Apple annual general meeting, and the question about the reappointment of the auditors was, why didn't they use iPads? So, you know, I don't think that forum is being used to grill the auditors. My section of the system is the microphone on. I want to say how strongly we support this, even though we were just on the sidelines, how important these recommendations are. And if anyone was in any doubt, we thought it would be interesting to look at the audit report in just one of the many companies that were big recipients of TARP and systemically connected into the mortgage crisis. So we chose Bank of America. Here's the audit report from 2008. And that cost $119 million. Here's the report in 2009. Word for word, exactly the same. And by now the price has gone up to $193 million. This is the 2010 report. Word for word, exactly the same. So with that as the backdrop, I think it really gives a sense of the urgency of tackling this issue. And we very much like the idea that's circulating in Europe, and I think it was touched on by Anne, that instead of trying to do something with this particular document, we might think about the idea of an auditor's discussion and analysis, which would be a different setting and allow for narrative reporting and something which is actually useful. I should also say that during this whole period, we didn't find an auditor with less than a 95% vote in favour of their reappointment. So I suggest the whole thing at the moment is being treated as a rubber stamp, and I doubt anybody reads it, because even though it's getting more and more expensive, it's not going to give you anything you didn't have several years ago. You know, and the auditor in this case has been auditing this company for decades. So that's what we're starting. Any improvement, much appreciated.
This is Lou Ferguson. As you looked at this, did you think about or think about the consequences, for example, if these reports are made more subjective and more analytic, what the consequences for comparability among reports would be and among, for example, among audit firms, that whether they might use different standards that would be difficult to compare? And how does one address that? I mean, one of the few advantages of a binary report is that presumably the language is both formulaic and it's either on or it's off and they're comparable. But as you get to a more analytic report, obviously there's much more subjectivity in it. How do we deal with that, and how do investors deal with that for purposes of comparing reports?
Let me take a first shot, Lou. A couple of responses. One, I think the sense that we have from our respondents is that they would prefer to keep the audit report as is, binary on or off, as you said, and then supplement it with an AD&A. And that may also get to Jim's concern about legal liability. There's ways to do that may help on that front. So it would be in an AD&A. Now, you still have the same issue. The AD&A may not be comparable, right? So it just translates to a different document. There's a couple of ways to potentially deal with that. One is, presumably, if the board did move forward on this and did require an AD&A, they would put some standards around it, right? So that's a challenge for Marty and his team, but I think they could take that on. So there would be some guidance on how auditors do this, so it wouldn't just be completely free form. Secondly, you do have an inspection and an enforcement function. And so if auditors don't apply some degree of consistent standards in doing this, you get at that through inspection and enforcement. But there's also a third way, and that is the market, right? You know, Gus has a lot of smart people working at Vanguard. And that what they'll find is if these disclosures are not transparent or not good, and if over time the disclosures of things like risks and uncertainties and judgments don't map to subsequent realizations, when Vanguard casts their vote on whether KPMG or Ernst or Deloitte or whoever Grant is reappointed, maybe they won't vote for a man, and maybe it won't be 95% anymore. So more information generally makes markets work better.
One observation is, I mean, I think the biggest risk, obviously, with any request for more disclosure is that we end up with boilerplate disclosure. So I think there would be an expectation that certain companies would have different disclosures. I mean, you would hope the reports would not be the same because they're different entities, I think, with different approaches, different tones at the top. And I have to second what Joe says. If we can develop, if you can develop a format that provides meaningful, non-boilerplate types of disclosures to investors, I think actually there will be pressure from the marketplace to increase the standards. It will be a great way to compare what the firms are doing. And I think ultimately it's going to be in the best interest of the marketplace at large.
Could I weigh in? I agree violently with everything that Joe and Ann just said, but I wanted to relate your responses back to Jim's question a minute ago about the perhaps in some respects overarching issue here of auditor liability. And you know, that is a concern I hear in a lot of discussions I've had. There's a flavor of it, I think, in the survey results, but certainly in people I talk with about this issue, you always hear the concern expressed that if there are new disclosure and reporting standards imposed on auditors, it will devolve into lawyer-drafted boilerplate, much as the current auditor's report is for that very, very concern. So there's a tension here, but I also think an opportunity to strike a balance, in which, as Ann very rightly says, that it may be appropriate to prescribe a format in which the enhanced auditor disclosure will occur, but permit it to occur in a way that it is necessary that in order to comply there be a substantive narrative discussion and disclosure of these important categories of issues in a way that invites comparison among companies and gives investors actual meaningful information, meaningful intelligence to inform their investment decision. And that I think is the key balance to be struck here and in any new rules going forward.
Why don't we recognize Barbara, Gus, Lynn, and then, Jim, if you or Mike have anything that you want to either ask or engage, the chairman's got to get out of here at 11:10. I want to save 3 minutes for myself for a question. But why don't we go in that order? And then if there's additional time, we can recognize others. Barbara.
Thanks. First of all, Joe, great presentation, everybody. That was really terrific. So as I look at these issues, it strikes me that there ought to be two goals coming out of this. One is that you focused on extensively, which is giving investors better, more useful information. But the other is, at least as I think about it, how do we drive the behavior that we want in the audits? And I think ever since I started on the SAG, I've heard someone at every meeting, so I'll be the one at this meeting, who says, you manage what you measure. And to the degree that we require some of this information to be brought out in the open, and I would say make auditors accountable for how they present this information, you know, I think it has an opportunity, one, to help in this, you know, really huge challenge we're facing, is how do we ever get auditors to think of themselves as working for investors? This, I think, is helpful in help in making them sort of think about how they're communicating with investors, talking to investors, rather than just rubber stamping a management document. And if they have to report on some of these issues about risks and whatnot, maybe they'll think a little more seriously about them when they do that. And I think that would be useful in some of this helping to change the culture. But, you know, I have to say, this issue of liability drives me a little crazy, because it would be hard for me to imagine how it would be more difficult in this country at this point to sue auditors after PSLRA and after all of the court decisions that we've been through. And it is this immunity from liability that I think has contributed to a culture in which auditors don't feel like they have to be responsive to shareholders, do find a way to get comfortable with management's numbers, and don't serve their public watchdog function. So while I recognize that the threat of liability is used as an excuse to present boilerplate information, and I think that's a threat in this area, that we will end up with boilerplate, somebody needs to be prodding them from the other side and saying, look, it's not going to pass muster, and that strikes me as the responsibility of the board.
At the risk of piling on, I'd say that we recognize that what we're reading in a financial statement is an estimate, and a best estimate perhaps, and that there's subjectivity around that. But I think we would argue that more information is better than less. And even if an auditor gives us a range that isn't accurate, at least it's probably a more informed view than we can do on our own independently, because obviously they're much closer to the action than we are. Over time, as I think Joe and Ann indicated, we do think that those estimates will become better. We will have an idea, just developing our own time series, of successive estimates from a given auditor, and we'll know how to calibrate those. So I think we would certainly err on the side of more information, not less.
Steve, one brief interjection to Barbara's point. There are, of course, cases making their way along which come out of the financial crisis. We don't, for reasons that Dan discussed earlier, we don't discuss our investigations and our litigation. But we wouldn't want, taking Barbara's point, we would not want the group assembled to assume that we are simply quiescent and oblivious.
In fact, Jim, based upon conversations I've had with the defense bar, it seems like you guys are really stepping it up on the enforcement stuff, which is good to hear, knowing that won't come out for a long time. But I do have comments along two lines. One, the legal liability issue that Barbara mentioned, which we did discuss on the ACAP report, and then some of the other issues that have been teed up in the presentation. First, on the legal liability issue, the ACAP did request from the firms and the Center for Audit Quality a fair amount of data on the cases, so we could go in and look at the cases and see what the cases actually involved and whether or not these were legitimate cases or not. The firms refused to provide us that data, quite frankly, which was somewhat disturbing when you compare it to available data. If you looked at the Stanford Clearinghouse Cornerstone Research, NERI, on average for the last 5 years, notwithstanding the fact that time frame encompasses when there's literally been hundreds, thousands of restatements, when there's been a subprime financial crisis, we have averaged just 6 cases being filed against the entire auditing profession on securities matters involving federal securities law, just 6 a year on average for the last 6 years. It goes to Barbara's point that with the Dura Pharmaceutical case, which upped the bar phenomenally with respect to loss causation and with respect to Talabs, it has made it almost impossible to sue the auditor today. So unless the auditor is going out and in one of these statements, expanded statements, making misstatements that they knowingly know or recklessly made, there's no risk of litigation. You know, someone may sue them, but those cases aren't even getting past the motion to dismiss these days. So despite the fact that the firms like to always take us back to the 80s and early 90s, pre-SLRA, when there was a lot of litigation, that times have changed. That's just not the case today. And legal liability, unless the firms are willing to come forward and make public what those cases are and demonstrate that they are, you know, there's a legitimate concern over some of these things, that's something that just shouldn't be done. I recall when we were doing the auditor independence rules, the firms all came in and said, if we did those rules, we'd destroy the profession. They couldn't hire anyone. Kids wouldn't want to join on. They met with Commissioner Hunt at the time. He wrote him a letter saying, well, give me the data. And the firms, again, refused to provide him the data. So they said, you can't go forward with the rulemaking without the data, but we won't give you the data. And it seems like that's what we've got. It's certainly what we saw with the ACAP committee. So I think the litigation issue is a huge red herring, and I think if you go back and read the results in the ACAP report, you'll see that there's discussion about just that in that report in light of what they couldn't get it, wouldn't give us. On some of the issues that are up here in front, I understand the SEC is going to hold hearings this summer, as was mentioned, on financial reporting and auditing, and I think that is fantastic. I think that's a very good proactive move. I think there are some serious issues out there. But I think as I look at this, it reminds me a lot of the earnings management initiative that we did. And we broke that up in between the auditing groups, the accounting standard setting group, and the piece to the SEC, and I see a lot the same. Here people are asking the auditor to say, tell us about the unusual transactions. Well, that was a recommendation in the 1978 Manny Cohen report saying the FASB ought to turn around and require disclosure of all unusual transactions. The FASB, unfortunately, never acted on that. If we'd had that, when Cohen so aptly recommended it, we wouldn't have some of these problems. But I think that is really a FASB, something in the FASB arena rather than in your arena or the auditor. And I'd say the O'Malley panel in 2000 recommended that the FASB put out something on going concern. That's 11 years ago now, coming up on 11 years ago. That, I think, O'Malley had it right. That's in the FASB arena, and they've been slow, extremely slow. Our standard setters at times are slower than a seven-year itch on acting on some of these. You know, 11 years probably, someone ought to be able to write that standard.
But Lynn, I don't want to do it to you again, but I think I have to because the chairman's going to get out of here in 10 minutes. Tony's got his card up. Brandon's got his card up. I want to give Jim an opportunity, and I'll cede my time, unfortunately, although if there is any time,
hold on for one second.
I want to get to any benefit-cost analysis you've done with respect to your one or two top recommendations. So take another minute. Let's see if we can wrap up in 10 minutes, and go ahead, Lynn.
Yeah, so I'd come back and I'd say you can split some of this up. I think some goes to the FASB, some is in the purview of the PCAOB. And you ought to sit down with the three of you and divvy it up who's going to do which pieces. On the risk management piece, Mary, you'll recall the big six firms at the time, big eight, I guess, came to the commission in with a very good proposal on what should be done with respect to disclosures on risk management. And I think that's worth – I think what the firms had put together was very good, and it's worth going back and revisiting that again. As well, because I think they had some good ideas then that people poo-pooed, and I think in hindsight, what the firms had recommended, probably people should have given more thought to.
A quick word for incrementalism. I think people should speak truthfully, and it would be helpful if we had a more robust discussion and analysis by the accountants. But if I could get there by sacrificing redoing the litigation reform debate, and if I could get there quickly rather than try and make sure that I get a fully robust discussion, I'd rather break the dam, as it were, and get that discussion and analysis and then fight another day about legal liability and the robustness of that discussion.
I just wanted to say that based on the last 11 years of being a standard setter and many more years of working with different standard setting bodies, the cost to standards of this issue of legal liability for auditors has been enormous, and it continues to weigh on us. They're always invoking it. It always affects the standards that we have, and I think it's time that we did something about that.
Jim, would you like to make any comments, or Mike?
Sure. One, I think thanks. You've made a compelling case that when your customer says they want more, the status quo isn't acceptable. And I think the case is compelling for that. Lynn, I think, actually addressed my biggest question, was whether this is just an issue about auditing standards. In some cases, estimates or judgments. I'm really interested in if that's a cry for we're not getting what we want out of accounting standards, and if we're not getting it there, is there more to be done on the audit front? And so I think you were pretty clear that a holistic approach, if something's broken the accounting standards, let's focus there. But if there's any more on that, I'd really be interested as well.
The only thing I would add quickly to that is, and this is only a couple of anecdotes, a couple of investors told me this when I talked to them via phone, is they said you know, the FASB has become so prolific in disclosures that some would argue there's disclosure overload. And so there's issue of the quality, but there's also this, the issue of the quantity. And one of the things they like about the auditor giving some opinions in these areas or additional color around these areas is that best management is biased. Even if they're honest, they're still biased because they see the world through their own lens. And the second problem is you've got to wade through that. And they felt that it would be both more objective and much more efficient. And they really estimate, they really emphasize the limitations on their time. If the auditors would succinctly, in an AD&A, talk about some of these things. Now, again, we didn't ask that specifically, so that's only a couple of people who told me that via phone. But that's at least one counterargument to just relying on the notes for the disclosure.
I appreciate the point on objectivity, which is a passion of mine, and I think will come up throughout the rest of the day as well, is are there things, if we're going to increase the reliance on auditors for providing additional information beyond pass-fail, what additionally do we need to do about objectivity?
Yeah, Jim, I think you raise exactly the issue, and I hope you'll take this up in the roundtables. But the bottom line is to actually you and Joe make good points. There's data with respect to estimates that auditors probably aren't on top of it as management is. So that should be in the footnotes, and I think, yes, investors have been clamoring for more in the footnotes. With respect to estimates, you can look at FASB projects over the last three decades, and one after another, investors have clamored for that from the FASB, and the FASB doesn't give it to them. So it's no surprise we are where we are today. I personally think there is just a serious deficiency in that process. On the other hand, it is clear that investors I've talked to, while they want to get the information from management, they also want to get the investor's perspective. And the audit firms have been saying, well, let the audit committee provide that. But the audit committee, and I've served on four of these, the audit committee doesn't have the same perspective because they're not out there doing the audit. So we also want to hear from the auditor their color commentary on that data. And so what you're really looking for is a wholesome product that gives you both better disclosures and information that rightly should come from and be the responsibility and obligation, quite frankly, the liability of management, and then this color commentary from the auditor on that information. And that takes kind of a joint work of all three of you, quite frankly, to get it done right. So I think you're dead on target with what you were suggesting there.
Just answer my question, and that is with respect to the benefit cost analysis of your top two recommendations. Have you thought about it? How costly is this going to be versus how beneficial it will be?
This is obviously opinion. We don't have any data on this. But if you look at our top two recommendations, more information about the auditor's assessment of risk, Steve, and more information about the auditor's assessment of estimates and judgments. If the auditor hasn't gathered that information, it's not a gas audit. You can't do a gas audit without assessing risk. You can't do a gas audit without assessing estimates and judgments. So clearly they have the data. We're not talking about, this is not 404B revisited. Okay? This is data that exists in the work papers. So any incremental cost, and I don't want to, you know, don't want to start the hornet's nest again, but any incremental cost would only really be reflective if firms feel that as a result of disclosing that, their liability goes up and they try to price that. Beyond that, I don't see where the incremental cost really is coming from because the data exists.
Okay, Bob, you've got the last word.
Steve, I just wanted to mention that the auditors are already providing this kind of sensitivity analysis to the audit committee by virtue of required disclosures to audit committees. I think what our group is suggesting is that that gets translated in a meaningful way to investors, not just audit committees.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you, Joe, for all the work. Thank you very much for the group. Chairman Shapiro, thank you first and foremost for spending the time. We know your busy schedule, and as I said, we really appreciate your coming. Thank you. And why don't we take a 15-minute break and get back here at, 11:30. Thank you.